Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The reigning theory of how the universe began, the Big Bang Theory, has won over everyone from cosmologists to school children. But the story of how the Big Bang came to rule our comprehension of the universe and of just how big a feat of insight it represents is less well understood. Particle physicist and best-selling author Simon Singh is a whiz at laying it all out. Tonight, we'll hear it from the very origins of space and time. This hour, On Point, sizing up the Big Bang. You can join the conversation. How would you explain the Big Bang to a 10-year-old? Could you? Can you really explain it to yourself? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is best-selling science writer Simon Singh. He's a former BBC producer, a PhD in particle physics from Cambridge University, and author of one of the big hits, The Code Book and Fermat's Enigma. His new book is Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. Good evening and welcome, Simon Singh.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
Wonderful to have you. So there are. You've been making popular science understood all around the block, Fermat's Enigma and all the rest. Now you're taking on the Big Bang. And when you talk to people about it, do they really understand it?
No, they don't. I think that's actually why I started to write the book. I was chatting to somebody on a plane, and you know, what do I do? What do you do? And we got to chatting, and I told them I wrote books, and we got to talking about cosmology and science. And it just struck me that people really don't know what the Big Bang theory is, and perhaps even worse, they think it's just a fairy tale. You know, cosmologists often talk about multiverses and time travel and weird things. Mm-hmm. And what they don't realize is the Big Bang is not so weird. It's not just speculation, but there's evidence to back it up. And so I wanted to tell people what the Big Bang theory is and why it's such a compelling theory.
Everyone has a sense, I think, at first blush that they can understand it. It sounds simple. There was a big explosion way back at the beginning of everything. And from that, the universe expands. We're still part of it. But you're saying they're really not sure if it's true or a fairy tale, and not really sure beyond that very basic thing how it works. I love how clearly you point out what an accomplishment it is to have figured out the Big Bang Theory. I mean, you quote, Sir James Jeans. All right, thank you. Saying, reminding us just how vast the universe is and how sparsely populated, certainly by folks like us. He says, place three grains of sand inside a vast cathedral, and the cathedral will be more closely packed with sand than space is with stars, let alone planets. Here's this enormous vastness, this one little planet that we're floating around on, and from that planet, the very origin of the universe is figured out. An incredible accomplishment.
Yeah, we're part of a very privileged generation. For thousands of years and for hundreds of generations, humans have tried to work out where did everything come from. And early societies had creation myths, and every society had its own myth, pretty much based on its own environment and its own experiences. But what science said is, forget myths. Myths are very interesting. They're nice. They reflect the culture. But what's the actual reality? What's the truth? Let me come up with an argument, and then you can test it, and you can criticize it. You can tear it apart. You can come up with a better argument. But bit by bit, let's see if we can get the right explanation. And today, you know, we are the first generation that have access to a verifiable, reasonable, sensible, compelling theory of the universe's history and its origins.
And you remind us just how extraordinary that is, A, to have it figured out, and B, to be living essentially, in cosmic terms, certainly, in the moment that it's been figured out.
Yes, yeah. I suppose it's worth saying here, I mean, I think nearly every working cosmologist would believe in the Big Bang. There are a few mavericks who disagree, and that's good because you shouldn't get complacent. But the Big Bang is pretty much a standard theory. It's a foundation of cosmology, but it's not quite complete. There are some gaps, and I'm sure people will ring in and point out some of the gaps in the Big Bang.
And I want to come back and look at that, because inciting all the myths and views that humans have held before, and in one by one them being knocked down and shown to be false, you can't help but wonder, well, is there something that we might still be missing today? Is there something out of whack, even the Big Bang theory? But it might be helpful, before we turn to calls that are already coming in here, and before we look at how the Big Bang was laid out, if you just take us through the basics, because I think a lot of people throw the phrase around, and no doubt myself most of all, but don't really understand what they're talking about when they say the Big Bang. What is it? What was it? What's the word?
Okay, so the Big Bang. Maybe it's worth comparing it with the opposite, or what came before the Big Bang theory. The traditional view was that the universe has just been here forever. It's been here forever.
Static state.
It doesn't change. It's the same yesterday as it will be tomorrow, and it's been here for eternity.
And we're not talking about a view that was millennia ago. This was at the beginning of the 20th century.
That's right.
And well into the 20th century, many people believed.
Well, yeah. I mean, Einstein was part of that generation. We kind of think of Einstein as being a modern 20th century physicist. But in fact, he was part of that generation that believed that the universe had been here forever. The Big Bang theory, on the other hand, a chap called Georges Lemaître, a Belgian priest, actually, interestingly enough, said, no, the laws of physics would allow for all of the matter, all of the energy, all of the space to have been compacted into what he called a primeval atom. So everything would have been small, dense, hot, and compact.
A primeval atom, one particle so condensed that it contained all of what would later be the universe.
That's right. And big atoms, things like uranium and plutonium, are very unstable.
What year was this when a Belgian priest was
1927.
Okay.
So people actually were coming across big atoms like plutonium and uranium, and people knew that those atoms were unstable, and they fractured and they exploded apart. So a super atom, an atom that contained everything, would fracture so incredibly violently that it would cause the explosion and creation and expansion of the universe. Then all those particles flew apart. They congealed together and formed the stars and the galaxies we see today. And according to Lemaître, those stars and galaxies should still be flying apart because they're still the debris, the remnants of this cosmic explosion. And that's essentially the Big Bang theory.
Now, take us back to it, though. This was, we think about it as an explosion, and you say that's not a wholly inappropriate way of thinking, but is it just like an explosion in space, like a stick of dynamite thrown out? You say one thing that's hard to get our heads around, it was not an explosion in time, but an explosion of time, not in space, but of space. What do you mean?
Well, not only was matter and energy created in the Big Bang, but space and time were created in the Big Bang.
Explain that.
I think prior to Einstein, people just thought that space was there. It was just a grid in which things happened, and time was just a clock that ticked away quite merrily. Now scientists think of time and space as a real entity, something that's flexible, something that can be manipulated, and therefore space and time itself could be created.
So they had their own origins. These are not eternal elements.
That's right. And in fact, when people talk about the expansion of the universe, it's not so much that the galaxies are flying through space, it's that the space in between the galaxies is expanding. So some of our conventional ideas of an explosion don't really relate to the Big Bang. And, you know, the Big Bang wasn't very big because it started off very small, and it didn't necessarily go bang because, you know, that requires air and so on. So it's a nice metaphor for what happened, and I think it's not a bad way to explain the theory. It's not a bad name. People once I remember there's a lovely Calvin and Hobbes cartoon strip where Calvin says, this is a magnificent theory of creation, but it's such a silly name, Big Bang. And Hobbes says, oh, why don't you come up with a better name? And Calvin says, I know, we'll call it the horrendous space kablooey. And there was a time when physicists wrote papers about the horrendous space kablooey, or the HSK theory of creation. But Big Bang is the name that we usually use.
And take us a little further in again, and I'm sure we'll come back to this before this show is out. I have no doubt of it. But you quote humorously toward the end of the book, St. Augustine, about people who ask, well, in his case, they ask, well, if God made everything, then who made God? Of course, the question that arises out of the Big Bang and this great condensed particle that blew up into everything that we now observe, in the theory of the Big Bang, is what came before it considered? Is it part of the theory, or is that yet to be deduced, discovered, figured out?
I mean, it's just coming back to St. Augustine, St. Augustine was asked, what was God doing before he created the universe? His reply to that was, well, he was creating hell for people who ask questions like you. It's a horrible question. It's a difficult question. What came before the Big Bang? It's nobody clearly knows, but scientists speculate. And just because they don't know now, it doesn't mean that they'll never know. And on the one hand, for example, the worst case scenario, the worst answer that people really hate this answer, but it's actually not such a bad answer, is that if time itself was created in the Big Bang,
okay,
then you can't ask what came before, because before only makes sense if you have a continual time frame. So some physicists say the question what came before the Big Bang is meaningless if time itself was created in the Big Bang.
Ever since the kind of Upanishads, you've got this notion of this germ floating, and the dense matter that exploded was something before it exploded.
Well, not necessarily. I mean,
I should say presumably, because I have no idea.
But a vision that's a bit like that is to say that our universe was born out of another universe. So previously there may have been another universe, and that would have been our mother universe, and mm-hmm. our universe in turn may give rise to a daughter universe. So you have a family tree of universes, and there may be infinitely many members of this family. And so people sometimes talk about the multiverse, which is a family of universes.
So that we live in one that may have been born out of the matter of an earlier universe.
That's right. And that's a nice theory. People like the multiverse because if there are so many, people are shocked that there's life in this universe. Life is an incredibly rare, special entity. It requires a unique set of conditions for life to arise. So people say, how come life arose? You know, maybe somebody tuned our universe so it's just right for life. Now, multiverse people would say there are so many universes that one of them was bound to be just right for life. And, of course, we happen to live in one of those universes because we couldn't live anywhere else. So this is now, you know, definitely in the realm of speculation. But who knows? You know, the Big Bang theory 50 years ago was speculation. Now we have the evidence to know that that's true. Maybe the multiverse will one day be proved.
There's such a lattice work of scientific inquiry and discovery that this whole theory sits on. And we're going to talk about that this evening because, I mean, really, much of your book is giving credit where credit's due and often missed there, starting with your Belgian priest and right on through step by step, the pieces coming together. And it didn't all happen in a Big Bang. It happened over much of a century.
Yeah, the book is really, actually, what the book's really about is how science works. My first book, Fermat's Enigma, was really about how maths works. What are mathematicians? What do they do? Why do they do it? How do mathematical ideas get developed? This is about how scientific ideas get developed. Happens to be about the Big Bang theory, but actually it's very typical for anything in science. Somebody comes in with a maverick idea. Generally, those ideas are wrong, and they get thrown out very quickly. But if your idea actually is right, even though people may rubbish you, eventually you can go away, you can get the evidence, you can come back, and slowly your maverick idea overturns the establishment in what's called a paradigm shift.
Well, you're lucky if that happens. If the telescopes get built, if the evidence can be gathered, if it comes in, and in this case, it has. It did.
Yes, the Big Bang theory is just a theory. But it's a theory with a huge amount of evidence to back it up. There are relics, there are fossils, there are things left over. The Big Bang theory makes clear predictions about how the universe must be if the Big Bang theory is true. Sure enough, all those predictions have been borne out.
There they are, sitting right there. We're going to dive into all that tonight. Look at the players, the scientists who step by step laid this out. And we want to hear from you as well. We're talking about the Big Bang, the theory that changed everything in the 20th century, or at least the way we understand everything. My guest tonight is Simon Singh. He's author of Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. You can join the conversation. How would you explain the Big Bang to a 10-year-old? Could you? Can you explain it to yourself? And how do you visualize that explosion, not only of space, but of time itself? Did your high school physics teacher explain the Big Bang in a way you really understood Do you understand it now? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Simon Singh in a moment. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the story of the Big Bang. Notions about the birth of the universe have abounded not only in science, but in science fiction. In Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, researcher Ford Prefect roams deep into space researching an encyclopedic guidebook. Here, he gives his own version of the way the universe began to his friends at the restaurant at the end of the universe.
I mean, do you know how the universe began for a kickoff?
Probably not.
Well, all right, imagine this. You get a large round bath made of ebony.
Where from?
No, listen. Just imagine that you've got this ebony bath, right? And it's conical.
Conical?
It's conical, okay? So what you do, you fill it with fine white sand, right? Or sugar, or anything like that. And when it's full, you pull the plug out, and it all just twirls down out of the plug hole.
Why?
But the thing is, the clever thing is that you film it happening. You get a movie camera from somewhere and actually film it. But then you thread the film in the projector backwards.
Backwards?
Yeah, neat, you see. So what happens is you sit and you watch it, and then everything appears to spiral upwards out of the plug hole and fill the bath. Amazing.
And that's how the universe began?
No, but it's a marvelous way to relax.
Funny man.
Well, broke the ice, didn't it?
Okay, there's the rubbish version. Be glad you live in the age when the Big Bang is understood increasingly. That was Jeffrey McGivern as Ford Prefect explaining how the universe began in the BBC's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. We're happy to be joined tonight by Simon Singh, author of the new book Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. You can join the conversation as well. What do you want to know about the Big Bang, and do you realize how remarkable it is to live in the time when the origin of the universe was finally figured out? Do you believe it's been figured out? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Simon Singh, so many notions over the centuries, as you said, zillions of myths. Every culture had one, had its own, often distinctive to its own environment. I wish you'd take us from that kind of that ancient soup of human understanding of the origin of the universe and how it in this kind of spiraled down toward what's much more specific today.
I think the important thing is the birth of the scientific method. The fact that it doesn't matter what the priests say, it doesn't matter what the politicians say, it doesn't matter even what the philosophers say. If I've got an idea, I can. In fact, it doesn't even matter what our common sense tells us. That's the other thing that often misleads us. You know, if we looked out of a window, we'd see that the Earth was flat. It's quite clearly flat. We're sat here at a table.
To the horizon.
Yeah, and we're clearly not moving. We're not. You know, the ground is not being swept from under
us. Right. So common sense, common Schmitz.
Yeah, the Earth is flat and it doesn't move. And yet someone like Copernicus comes along and says, well, actually, you know, I've made some really careful observations. And as far as I'm concerned, the Earth does move.
It took a heck of a long time to get to that point, to get to the point of scientific inquiry.
Yeah. Well, in fact, if you go back to the early Greeks, Aristarchus actually proposed that the Earth went round the sun. But
sort of 5th, 6th century B.C.?
Something like that. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, a good couple of thousand years before Copernicus. And yet he couldn't get his idea accepted because he didn't have the evidence to back it up. And that's kind of fair enough. But eventually, you know, in the time of Copernicus and in the century that followed, you have someone like Galileo who looks out and sees, I think, the moons of Jupiter. And he says, look, here's Jupiter. It's got moons. Mm. Things are going round Jupiter. Now, if things are going round Jupiter, that means that not everything has to go around the Earth. Because prior to this, the Earth was at the center of absolutely everything. Mm-hmm. So once you can break that apparent fact that everything must go around the Earth, then you can begin to tolerate the possibility that the Earth itself might go around the sun.
But even with that, you fast forward to 1900 or so, and as you write, cosmologists still believe that the universe was not created, but it had existed for eternity. This kind of, static?
A steady state universe. Yeah, I think that's a situation whereby people like the idea, scientists like the idea of an eternal universe, because if the universe has been here forever, you don't need to worry about when it was created, how it was created, or who created it. So the eternal universe is a very nice theory. It's consistent. But in fact, scientists back then would have admitted we don't actually have any evidence for that. When we try and date things, they only tend to be a few billion years old. We don't have any evidence that there are truly, truly ancient objects.
So take us through the steps. You mentioned Lemaître, if I've got that right, in Belgium.
Yeah. Georges Lemaître.
Lemaître, excuse me. And now take us on through the steps that began to really unspool this understanding.
He says, theoretically, the universe could have been created. So he's a theoretical cosmologist. He says the laws of the universe would allow for an expansion of some hot, dense, compact object into the universe we see today, and the universe today would still be expanding.
But this was such a radical notion, he needed a lot of backup before people could begin to buy into this.
Einstein said to him, your physics is, what was the word he used? Your physics is appalling, he said. So Einstein rubbished him, the establishment rubbished him, particularly they were aggressive towards him because Lemaître was a priest as well as a cosmologist. Mm-hmm. And people said, if you know, the reason you want to have a creation is because a creation implies a creator, and you're trying to smuggle God into physics.
Right.
And Lemaître said, no, I believe in this theory because it's good physics. Mm-hmm. I believe in religion, and that tells me about the spiritual world. I believe in science, and that tells me about the material world. I don't use my science to back up my faith. I don't use the Bible to back up science.
But eventually Einstein came around. What brought him around?
When you have evidence, that's what Lemaître was waiting for. He was waiting for evidence to back up his theory. In 1929, you have the great American astronomer Edwin Hubble working at Mount Wilson in Southern California. He looks up at the night sky, and he's able to measure the velocity of the galaxies. And whenever he looks at a distant galaxy, in every single case, the galaxies are moving away from us. Mm-hmm. And this was a shock. This was a shock to the world. Every single distant galaxy is running away from us as though they're the remnants of this cosmic explosion. So just as Lemaître had predicted, the observations showed the universe is expanding. And once you have a little bit of evidence like that, you can begin to win over the critics. It's not conclusive evidence. It's like when it's as if you're putting somebody on trial. A fingerprint is good evidence, but what you really want is an eyewitness. You want forensic evidence. You want DNA evidence. So people then wanted even more evidence to prove the Big Bang Theory. But at least it was beginning to turn the tide.
And it continued to come through the 60s, right into the 90s.
Yes. I think one of the bits of evidence that helped prove the Big Bang was the physics of the very small. If the Big Bang, people said in the 1940s, if there was a Big Bang, and there always had to be this big if because nobody really knew back then there would have been nuclear reactions in the very early universe. We would have started off with simple hydrogen because the early universe was simple and hydrogen is number one in the periodic table. But the hydrogen would have undergone nuclear fusion and created helium. And if the Big Bang Theory is correct, we can work out how much hydrogen and how much helium there should be today. And the predictions showed that the universe should be 3/4 hydrogen, 1/4 helium.
And?
When you look up there, that's what you find. 3/4 hydrogen, 1/4 helium. The only way you can explain that is through the Big Bang.
And so what you come up with ultimately is a paradigm shift. That's a phrase that got thrown a lot in the 1990s. But you mean it in vast scientific terms. And describe the paradigm shift, the fundamental shift in thinking about the universe that once you have the Big Bang Theory supported by evidence, this shift comes. What is it?
The phrase paradigm shift, I think, was invented by Thomas Kuhn specifically about science. It's now used more generally, but it was a term developed by philosophers of science. Prior to the idea of the paradigm shift, people thought that science evolved. So you have an idea, and then you tweak it, and you tweak it, and you have some other evidence, and you change it slightly, and you end up with a slightly new, different idea. No, the way science can work when big ideas are involved is that the big idea, the old idea, might be fundamentally wrong. And therefore, the new idea has to have a revolution to throw it out.
And so here was a revolution with what ramifications?
I think the ramifications were that I think the old paradigm had nothing to back it up. And if you have an old paradigm...
Steady state.
The eternal universe was fundamentally flawed. It had nothing to back it up. And if you built anything on top of that foundation, ultimately it was going to fail because the foundation was flawed. Once you have a good foundation, which is the Big Bang Theory, then you can start building with strength. Suddenly things make sense. For example, in the 1960s, people discovered radiation coming from outer space. Mm-hmm. It was microwaves mm-hmm. coming from all space at all times. Now, in the eternal universe, nobody would have been able to explain what that radiation was.
In the old steady state notion.
Yes, there's no reason why the universe should be full of radiation. If anybody tunes their radio, not now, but if they tune it in between stations, right. they'll hear a hissing sound. Mm-hmm. 1-2% of that energy being picked up by their aerial is radiation coming from outer space, microwaves. In the Big Bang picture, it makes complete sense. That radiation is the radiation left over from the Big Bang. It's the afterglow of the Big Bang. And in fact, Big Bang theorists had predicted it. They'd said there must be microwaves in the universe. They'd predicted the actual wavelength of the microwaves, and that's exactly what you see.
And the theory began to pull it all together. We've got about 100 billion callers who want to join this conversation. Simon Singh is my guest tonight. His new book is Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. Ernst is calling from Black Wolf, Wisconsin. Hi, Ernst, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that the gentleman and science in general has fallen for the same type of need for coherence that the ancient myths did. First of all, one has to remember that for thousands of years, these myths promulgated a creation for the universe. When science was formed, it didn't do that for about 400 years. So there is some capacity in the myths that science did not have. The other thing is that again, the gentleman, and science does this in general, is explaining these in terms of 18th century science. As Buckminster Fuller pointed out over 50 years ago, science left the four-dimensional universe in the 1800s and has latched upon time as an explanation. I think in terms of the theory of the creation of the universe, we are still in kindergarten. And things like the extra solar planets that they have found, which exceed the size that they should be possible without turning into suns, the fact that we are finding a counter-gravity force that seems to be speeding up on the fringes of the universe, the fact that our satellites seem to be slowing down when they reach the Oort cloud area, all of these things indicate inconsistencies that I think we've got a lot more to learn.
Ernst, let me ask you, are you then saying, that to your mind, the Big Bang Theory is no more substantial than the ancient myths, or simply that it's a very early step on a long staircase?
I think it is an early step.
Got it. Ernst, thanks for your call. Simon Singh?
I think it's more than an early step. I think we're halfway up the staircase, but I think it's important I'm kind of selling the Big Bang and saying it's real, it happened. And I genuinely believe that. And I think 99% of cosmologists genuinely believe that. But at the same time, cosmologists aren't so arrogant that they wouldn't say there are many things we don't understand.
Pick up some of those. I don't know, either that Ernst mentioned or others. Counter-gravity, extrasolar planets.
I think that was a very good point that Ernst made about counter-gravity. You would expect gravity tends to pull everything inwards.
Mm-hmm.
The universe is expanding, so you would expect gravity to slow down that expansion. It should pull everything in. It might even halt the expansion one day. Mm-hmm. It may even cause a collapse and might even end the universe in a big crunch. Now, that's what I was taught 20 years ago.
Stephen Hawking used to talk about
this. Yeah, everybody's spoken mm-hmm. about that. When I was an undergraduate, it was kind of the slowing down of the universe was a kind of a fact.
Time will reverse one day.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But when people made measurements in 1998, so less than a decade ago, so this is relatively new physics, when they looked up at the universe, it's not slowing down. It's getting faster. It's a runaway universe. It's an accelerating universe.
Is that consistent with the Big Bang Theory?
Well, it's...
Why should it accelerate?
It's not inconsistent with the Big Bang Theory, if that's okay to say.
What's the fuel for the acceleration?
That's what nobody knows. It must be, Ernst used the phrase, counter-gravity, anti-gravity, the the buzzword tends to be dark energy. But to be honest, nobody really knows what dark energy is. It doesn't affect what happened at the beginning of the universe, really. But it certainly is an aspect of cosmology where physicists are really just coming to terms with this. And theorists, see, before we were saying that theorists come up with an idea, the observers then have to go away and prove it. Mm. Now the observers have come up with something and the theorists have to go away and prove it.
Jerry's calling from Traverse City, Michigan. Jerry, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I was wondering why there is so much controversy about the theory of evolution, but you never hear of any problems with the Big Bang theory. People don't seem to want to take that out of books, but when it comes to evolution, they get all excited.
That's a fascinating question. Is there some cultural reason that the notion of evolution itself would be so controversial, yet the Big Bang theory, which is kind of consistent with evolution, is not a target. Simon Singh, it may be unfair to ask you. You've come across the pond to be with us, but what's your sense?
I think it's a you know, the Bible has its own version of creation, so you know, why should people tolerate a scientific view of creation? I think that evolution and the Big Bang are the both big targets.
And yet
people.
Big Bang seems tolerated. What's your interpretation? And I know this is perhaps there's more controversy about evolution in the States than in the UK, but even so, what's your take?
I think there's more evolution taught at school. I think that's the first thing. I don't think Big Bang cosmology is such a big part of the curriculum, whereas evolution really is. You maybe learn it when you're 12, mm-hmm. 13, 14 years mm-hmm. old. It's central to all of biology. Big Bang isn't central to all of physics. So one is that evolution's a bigger target.
Is there something about the Big Bang theory that's either consistent or contradictory with traditional notions of God?
I don't think so. I see the two as being very, very separate. I don't have a problem with religion. I don't think religious people should have a problem with science.
You see it as being separate, but religions all talk about creation.
They do, but there are people like Georges Lemaître, the guy who came up with the Big Bang theory, a devout priest, a Catholic who had no problem resolving his scientific beliefs with his religious beliefs. John Polkinghorne, a brilliant physicist, a brilliant quantum theorist, again, an ordained minister.
Is Big Bang somehow more or less consistent with traditional religious faith than the steady state theory was, comfortable?
I think religious people tend to like the Big Bang theory more than the old view, because the Big Bang theory at least talks about a creation, and indeed Pope Pius XII endorsed the Big Bang theory in the 1950s at the papal address. Hmm. Now, some people then said to the Pope, look, don't get involved. If you're backing up the Big Bang theory, what you're saying is, in fact, what he did say, was that science was giving a vindication of the tale of creation as in Genesis. So he was using science to back up the biblical account.
A kind of version of Genesis.
That's right. And mm-hmm. people said, look, don't do that, because you're embracing science now. What happens when science disagrees with what's in the Bible? You mm-hmm. can't pick and choose. Mm-hmm. So the best thing is to keep the two very, very separate. And I think that's really what happens now. I think people are quite happy to use science as a tool for, you know, most people believe that the Earth is not 6,000 years old. They believe that
which
the Earth
would be biblical to times.
That's right. That was Bishop Usher's account based on rigid biblical scholarship.
Well, you may say most people are satisfied with that, but in the U.S. of A., there are some significant number who are not satisfied, to leave them apart. And it's fascinating, Jerry, to your question, that this goes relatively unchallenged, while evolution has all kinds of challenges, even now. We're talking tonight with Simon Singh, author of the new book, Big Bang. You can join the conversation. What do you think? After the Big Bang, what's left? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Big Bang and the theory that changed everything in the 20th century. My guest is Simon Singh, author of the best-selling Fermat's Enigma. Now he's out with Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. You can join the conversation. What do you want to know to say about the Big Bang? 1-800-423-8255. Shannon's calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Shannon. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
I'm a high school science teacher in Brooklyn, New York.
Super.
And I have a question that my students pose to me often, and I really can't answer.
Okay.
That's how could everything that exists, the entire universe, start out as something that is the size of an atom?
That's relatively trivial. That's relatively easy.
Oh, boy. Okay, yeah. So Shannon, get out your pen, you'll have the answer in a moment.
The thing, my background's in particle physics and not mm-hmm. astronomy, and so a lot of the ideas that I came across in the book were new to me when I first came across them. And the thing that really shocked me is that the universe really is basically made of nothing. You know, most of the universe is nothing. If you take an atom and you blew an atom up to the size of a giant concert hall, the nucleus of the atom would be the size of a pea in the middle of the atom, and in the middle of the concert hall, and the electron would be a tiny piece of dust floating around in this concert hall.
So even within the atom, it would seem empty to us.
It's essentially nothing. And then at the other end of the scale, you talked earlier about Sir James Jeans, that if the density of stars...
Three grains of sand in Notre Dame is the density of
exactly.
stars.
Exactly. The average... I mean, and that's surprising, because the average density of this table is about 1 gram per cc. The average density... the density of water is 1 gram per cc. Density of the sun is about 10 grams per cc. So everything around us has this typical density of a gram or two per cc.
Mm-hmm.
Average density of the universe, 1 gram per 1,000 Earths. 1 gram per 1,000 Earths. So there's just a huge amount of nothing. So you can kind of run the clock backwards, compress everything down, and it's pretty much possible to compress everything in the universe down to something, let's say, the size of an atom. And
because it's so empty overall. But Shannon's students might look at this table right in front of us and say, you know, that's got density that's more than the atoms you're talking about. The appearance of substance.
Yeah, it has the appearance of substance, but it's only the appearance, and we have to get over what our common sense tells us. But all I'm doing really is it's sidestepping the question, because you can run the clock back even further and the universe gets even smaller. It gets even smaller and smaller. All the known visible universe shrinks right down. Eventually, it apparently seems to shrink down to a point, what's called a singularity. And at that point, physicists don't have any answers, and I certainly don't have any answers. Physics, the laws of physics break down, and people need to come up with a new theory to actually explain the very initiation of the Big Bang. And people may have heard a lot about string theory. String theory might explain how things worked at that very small fundamental level. Atom, I think, is just about explicable. Once you get below that, things get really tough.
Shannon, if you tell your students, you can understand it, because the universe is essentially so empty, it's mainly nothing. Therefore, the actual density that's out there, the substances out there, could be in one very dense atom. Do you think that'll work?
I think so. I mean, what you're saying is when it was the actual atom, it was really, really dense.
Yeah, it was super dense, super dense. The analogy, again, maybe is with a neutron star. A neutron star is a star that's collapsed. So while the density of the sun is maybe 10 grams per cc, I can't remember the numbers now, but a teaspoonful of neutron star weighs as much as the entire solar system or something ridiculous like that. So the concept of density that we have around us is nothing compared to what's possible in a neutron star, and it's nothing compared to what would have been in the very early universe.
So a super density in that first atom, a super emptiness, in effect, in the universe that we live in now. Let's try
exactly.
and get one more call here. Shannon, thanks for yours. Justin's calling from Staten Island in New York. Hi, Justin. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Really interesting show. My question is concerning dark energy or anti-gravity, as the previous caller referred to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard the concept that our universe is, in fact, surrounded by other universes, and that the matter in the other universes, the gravitational pull of those, is responsible for the acceleration of expansion and the concept of dark energy.
Our time is short, but let us pick that right up, Justin. What about it? You talked about the multiverse, multiple universes, Simon Singh. Could it be the gravity of other universes invisible somehow around us, pulling?
I must admit, I've not come across this theory, but I think cosmologists are at a stage whereby any theory carries some weight, because there's nothing really there are no conclusive answers. So perhaps Justin's theory has some credence, but eventually one day we'll get some evidence and we'll know what's really driving this expansion.
And maybe we'll call it Justin's theory once we do. Justin, thanks for your call. Simonson, we've just got a couple of minutes left here. There's the Big Bang, 15 billion years ago or so. In the last century, figured it out, evidence for it. What's the next horizon, the next big question?
I think we just talked about dark energy. I think one of the things that scientists would really love to know about is something called dark matter. Now, dark matter is a substance. When people look at galaxies, they measure the force of attraction towards those galaxies, the force of gravity pulling things into those galaxies. Mm-hmm. The force of gravity is bigger than it should be. People can look at those galaxies, they can count all the stars in the galaxy, they know how heavy a star mm-hmm. is, so they can work out how much gravitational pull there should be. There's too much pull. So there must be something in that star that has mass, that has gravity, therefore it's matter, and it must be invisible, because if we could see it, we'd count it and we'd know it's there. So it must be dark, it doesn't shine. So that's why it's called dark matter. It's there, it has pull, but we don't see it.
So that remains to be figured out. And finally, I guess, can you imagine that one day we'll figure out something like that and that will unravel the Big Bang Theory? Or do you think this is going to endure even as these new insights gradually, eventually come in?
No, no. I'm fairly confident that they'll just add to the Big Bang. They'll fill in some of the gaps in our understanding. I think the phrase you just used there, something happened 15 billion years ago, I think that's the rock-solid statement. There was a moment of creation and an expansion and an explosion into the universe we see today, and the universe is still evolving. Some of the gaps as to some of the constituents of the universe, such as dark matter, are open questions, but I don't think it'll overturn the Big Bang.
Well, we still look to the future with some mystery and look back to the other side of that bang with a terrific mystery as well. But in between that huge Big Bang, we've got a lot to think about tonight. Simon Singh, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for the new book.
My pleasure.
Simon Singh, author of Big Bang, The Origin of the Universe. Listen, you can continue the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
I, George Walker Bush,
do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
I, Richard Cheney, do solemnly swear
that I will defend and support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
By our efforts, we have lit a fire as well. A fire in the minds of men. It warms those who feel its power. It burns those who fight its progress. And one day, this untamed fire of freedom will reach the darkest corners of our world.
Bring them home!
I've just been outraged at Bush's stand on the war and going to war.
Even though I step down as your secretary, I will never leave you. I will always be part of this wonderful family. Thank you all, and God bless you.
Well, if you can't admit to this mistake, I hope that you'll
Senator, we can have this discussion in any way that you would like, but I really hope that you will refrain from impugning my integrity. Thank you
very much. I'm just quoting what you said. You contradicted the president and you contradicted yourself.
There's a spot in the ground here where it stopped and exploded, just as the mosque was letting out, just as people were coming out of the mosque here.
I think that when you're the president of Harvard University, you are a leader of American education, and 50% of your students are women. And if the president doesn't think those women have the aptitude to get to the top, that's deeply concerning to me.
It will change the way that we travel. It is the largest civil aircraft ever built. It will carry record-breaking numbers of passengers over the world's oceans and continents.
And there's a week. President Bush and Vice President Cheney take their oaths of office during the nation's 55th inauguration. In his inaugural address, President Bush lays out a grand vision of America's role in the world. During his inaugural parade, Bush is greeted by supporters, but by thousands of protesters as well. Colin Powell says goodbye at the State Department, while his expected successor, Condoleezza Rice, faces tough questioning during confirmation hearings. Insurgents step up their violence. In Iraq, a car bomb detonated outside a mosque in Baghdad as worshippers were filing out today. killing at least 14 and injuring dozens. Harvard president Lawrence Summers raises a stir by asking if women might not be biologically wired to be great scientists. And Europe's Airbus rolls out a new 550-seat superjet. Jack Beatty, fly me to the moon.
Yes.
With 549 of my favorite friends.
That's right. That's right. And the captain of this airship is George W. Bush for 4 years.
GW.
And what a speech that was. Freedom from tyranny abroad, freedom from government at home. You know, you ask, well, why should we care whether other peoples are free? Well, because we can't be free unless they are, the president says. Of course, our historical experience has not been that. We lived with the Soviet Union that had an expansionist ideology threatening to our way of life and been a powerful state, and our freedom wasn't diminished.
Well, we fought it tooth and nail, though, to accomplish that.
Oh, that's true. That's true. But our freedom wasn't diminished by the Soviet Union's, as it were, slavery, or by the slavery of the captive peoples. Indeed, we lost our freedom only when we fought the war too hard and began to constrict our freedom ourselves. So it's quite a project the president wants to undertake. And no one seems to know what he means. Does he mean, as Cy Hirsch in a piece in The New Yorker has security people saying he means, that we're going to sponsor Contra-like insurrections against tyrannies? Does it mean that we're going to sponsor, death squads to assassinate terrorists? Does it mean that we're going to have invasions? Or is it just really rather a kind of propaganda exercise? We're going to talk about freedom. Take the bully pulpit. No one seems to know.
But then in a globalized world, maybe it's not so inseparable anymore. We've heard from George Lakoff earlier that Democrats need to redefine freedom. But just at a simple level, the president says, why should Americans doubt the power of freedom? And with everything we've heard about globalization, why should we doubt today that American freedom is intertwined with freedom elsewhere?
Yes, but it's not a necessary condition of our own freedom. It would be nice, it's desirable, and a work of ages, as the president says.
Mm-hmm.
And that does seem to be the current of the century. The question is, do you advance it through essentially arms or through subversion against other countries, or do you rather trust to the inherent appeal of freedom and democracy? Mm-hmm. President Reagan did the latter. President Bush seems to be tempted to do the former.
We heard or read Peggy Noonan, a big, great Republican speechwriter over many years, writing in the Wall Street Journal today that perhaps, in effect, she's saying, perhaps Bush has taken the big Republican message a bridge too far here, that they might have suffered some mission inebriation as they sat around writing this speech. What do you think, Jack? Has it finally been blown up to such a colossal project that it's unsustainable, or will this be inspiring to Americans, intimidating to tyrants, and successful?
I'm inclined to agree with her there. There was a lack of realism here. I mean, just a sort of almost common sense. We don't have the power to do all this. We want to give as much help as we can to people who want to be free, but it's not within our power to make them free. And when we try to, look what happens, as in Iraq. So I do think he soared too high here for any sort of policy that makes sense for this country today. And then at home, of course, he's facing political difficulties. Prominent Republicans criticizing the Social Security privatization, not sure they want to step over that cliff. And you've got Democrats maybe finding a new theme for their party, a theme perhaps more relevant than ever. Economic security. You know, just 20 years ago, 56% of American corporations said, you know, if employees are loyal to us, we should be loyal to them with continued employment. You know how many corporations say that now? 6%. That's an unprecedented form of insecurity. And, you know, the Democrats' whole idea that we shouldn't have to worry about our pensions, we shouldn't have to worry about our health insurance, and if we're not worried about those things, we'll have more entrepreneurial flexibility. Sounds a lot more relevant than it was, say, just a few years ago.
And yet it's a big world out there, a tough one, a lot of competition from China, and they don't care if you promise security or not. They're looking out for their own next bottom line. We'll be watching. Jack, thanks for being with us this week.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.